Johnson. For a minute, as you know, this past week has been a historical week, certainly in the life of this country of Iraq. And each of you out there has had a piece of that history, whether you've been involved in kicking Al-Qaeda out of the Euphrates River Valley, or keeping them out of Fallujah, or helping to train the Iraqi security forces so that they can take over their role of defending their country, and setting up that election last week. Whatever your job is, whatever your piece is, you contributed to it. And your sacrifice, your service is very much appreciated. Now it's my honor this morning to introduce to you someone who has come a long way to thank you for your service and sacrifice, someone who fights the same war you do, only in a different battle space. And I'd like you to join me in a hearty welcome this morning for the Secretary of Defense, the Honorable Donald Rumsfeld.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Please be seated. General Johnson, thank you so much for your hospitality. Marines, soldiers, I'm told there's some Seabees and Navy folks here. Hurrah! How about airmen? Louder. Well, and I guess there's contractors and civilians and so many other folks. I did want, as General Johnson said, to be here today to personally recognize the superb job you folks are doing. It is noted across the world. It's appreciated. And certainly I want to tell you, each of you, how grateful we are for your service, your sacrifice, and for your commitment to a truly historic cause. And to tell you how grateful your country is to you, and also to your families and loved ones. And how proud the American people are of what you are achieving here. Consider where we are today. The Fallujah of not that long ago was a symbol of rejection of the new democratic Iraq. Difficult days lie ahead, to be sure, but the Fallujah today has some of the highest voter registration and turnout rates in the country, has increasingly capable and confident Iraqi security forces in the streets helping to maintain order and hunting down terrorists. Fallujah is a place where the old adage about the U.S. Marines certainly fits. No better friend, no worse enemy. So I congratulate you for what you are accomplishing here. It's important. Consider as well what's happening across Iraq. Last week, the world watched with admiration and respect the Iraqis who defied threats to write a new chapter in the history of freedom. Last week's election, with the surprisingly strong turnout across the country, even in this area, was still another step forward for the Iraqi people. I certainly congratulate the General Casey and the very strong military team that we have here in Iraq for their capable leadership in assisting the Iraqi government and the Iraqi security forces in achieving the third successful election in less than 1 year. This month's election is only the latest mark of progress in Iraq as they build a free and democratic nation, a nation that can protect the rights of all Iraqis and defeat the terrorists. You think about it, what held this country together was repression, vicious repression that filled mass graves with hundreds of thousands of bodies of men, women, and children. That's how order was maintained in this country. The Iraqi people now have written a constitution and ratified a constitution, a piece of paper that is going to substitute for that repression. It is going to be that thing which will assure all of the people of this country their rights and their protections against each other and an opportunity for them and their families. The success we've had has been noted, and at the recommendation of our military commanders, in consultation with our coalition partners and in consultation with the Iraqi government, President Bush has authorized an adjustment in U.S. combat brigades in Iraq from 17 to 15. The size and composition of U.S. forces, of course, will fluctuate as commanders continue to shift their focus to emphasize training and supporting the Iraqi security forces. This will include some increases in U.S. forces involved in transition teams, intelligence support, and logistics to assist the security forces as they continue to assume greater responsibility for the security of their country. The effect of these adjustments will reduce U.S. forces in Iraq by the spring of 2006 below the high, the current high of roughly 160,000 during the election period when it was bulked up, and also below the 138,000 baseline that had existed prior to the most recent election. However, as the President has stated, force-level decisions are condition-based and will continue to be condition-based. They have been and will continue to be determined by assessments of Iraq's progress by U.S. military commanders on the ground and will include such factors as the growing capability and effectiveness of the Iraqi security forces, its leadership and its organization, the continuing handover by coalition forces of security responsibility to the Iraqis, and the continued political and economic progress in the country. The President has spoken about progress on the political, the economic, and the security fronts. On the basis of that progress, General John Abizay, the CENTCOM commander, and General George Casey, the Iraq commander, have recommended the force-level adjustments that we're initiating today. They will continue to monitor the situation closely and continue to consult with the Iraqi government and with our coalition partners in the coming months, and they'll make recommendations as appropriate. Assessments, as I say, will be made periodically depending on circumstances on the ground. Our force levels will continue to fluctuate somewhat during force rotations, such as the rotation which we're now beginning. The adjustments being announced are a recognition of the Iraqi people's progress in assuming greater responsibility for their country. It's also a recognition of your success in helping the Iraqi people build a better future. Let me be very clear. The challenges ahead, military, political, and economic, will not be easy. As the President has said, our forces will be available to help the Iraqi people establish their new democracy. The United States, as you all know better than any, did not come to Iraq for oil. We did not come to occupy this country. We came here only to help. So as we go forward, the coalition will continue to transfer responsibility for security operations to the Iraqi security forces and place more emphasis on supporting those forces through training, support activities, and counterterrorist operations. U.S. and coalition military leadership is trying to seek the proper balance between having a military footprint so large enough to help the Iraqi people win their fight against the terrorists, but not a footprint so large and so intrusive as to antagonize a proud and patriotic people, or to discourage the Iraqi people from taking initiative to run their own country themselves. Coalition leadership is continuously assessing that balance in consultation with the Iraqi government. We anticipate future coalition-level, force-level discussions at some point in 2006, after the new Iraqi government is in place and is prepared to discuss their future. And we will be consulting with our coalition partners as well. Violence in Iraq, unfortunately, as you well know, will likely continue to ebb and flow as terrorists and others continue to try to block Iraq's path to democracy, the path now clearly chosen by the overwhelming majority of the Iraqi people. Ultimately, it will be the continued wise choices by the Iraqi people that will end the violence in Iraq over time. After watching millions of Iraqis line up to vote last week, many of them dancing in the street, holding up purple-stained fingers with understandable pride, it's clear that the vast majority of this country is invested in a new democratic future for Iraq. And it is also increasingly clear that our strategy for victory here is winning. It's working. These achievements would not be possible were it not for you and the support of your families back home. Holiday season, of course, is a time when Americans reflect on families and friends and on what's most important in our lives. We might also reflect on what a very special, decent, and generous people Americans are. It's fallen to you to protect our way of life and to keep America that special place, the place where millions of people look to in times of danger and tragedy, the country to which millions more, at great risk to themselves, have crossed oceans and deserts to seek refuge. It is my honor, indeed the honor of my life, to work with those of you who defend that American dream during this time of peril for our country. I have seen countless soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines undertake grave duties with courage, with determination, and in the same moment render acts of kindness and compassion to others. I've marveled at the grit of the grievously wounded who've lost limbs but are determined to get back in the fight. And needless to say, we've all shared the grief of those whose loved ones have returned for a final tribute to their grateful country. The strength of our military, your strength, and that of your families, is truly amazing. It's extraordinary. And it never fails to give me strength and encouragement and indeed inspiration for the tasks ahead. So I thank you for that. I thank you for being who you are. And I thank you for doing what you do for all of us. Now, I'm told that there's some microphones in here. I see a couple. There it is. I would be delighted to visit with you and respond to some questions and hear what you have to say. And I would suggest that if you want to do it, you move around behind one of those microphones and raise your hand and have a go at it. How are you, sir?
Very well, Mr. Secretary. I'm Master Chief Terry Haynes, and I'm with the 30th Naval Construction Regiment Forward. I don't want to talk to you about or ask a question about reserve retirement. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk about reducing the retirement age below the age of 60 based on deployment time and years of service. And my question is, do you have any news with regard to whether that is going to happen, and if so, when?
I don't. It is a discussion that takes place, as you well understand. The task that the Congress and the executive branch have is to try to find the right balance in total compensation for the forces. Needless to say, we have a wonderful volunteer force. Not a one of you was drafted or coerced or forced to come into the service. Each one of you volunteered. You raised your hand and said, send me, and God bless you for it. And what we have to do is to see that we have the right incentives to attract and retain not just the troops and the Marines, but the families as well, and that it is an attractive set of incentives, and balance them among the active force, the Guard and Reserve, the retired community, and balance them among the different types of compensation, in some cases basic compensation, in other instances it involves things like health care, retirement pay, housing, and various other types of incentives. It is a complicated thing to do it, and to the extent we reach into the middle of it and change one thing, it can create disequilibrium or somewhat inequities elsewhere. So the Congress, we've got an outside commission that's looking at that total picture and trying to make sure that it's arranged in the best way. As I'm sure you've noticed, the last 5 years, there have been pay increases that have been steady. There have been targeted pay for elements of the military that seem to be behind the civilian competitive market. And there have been improvements also with respect to health care and retirement. How that mix will all come out, I don't know. I will say this about age. One of the things we've tried to do is to increase the age where people can enter the military because of the need in the modern military for a lot of skill sets that in many cases take some time for people to develop, and also to increase the age that people can stay in the military if they wish to because of the enormous capabilities that exist and experience that exist in people who've been in for a period. So we're trying to adjust it to fit the 21st century, and it certainly is something that's being considered. No one at that microphone, I can't believe it. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Greetings.
My name is CM1 Tyson with the Navy Seabees. My unit is currently deployed out of Gulfport, Mississippi, and as you know, sir, was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. We have moved our families, we've lost homes, and lost rental properties. Is there a referral program or system in place to help us find housing units when we get home?
There is. And I will see that General Johnson has given that information. There were immediately phone banks set up and linkages established for people, and the process has been partly military and partly outside of the military in the executive branch of the federal government, and we'll be happy to gather that information for you and see that it's provided to you. I must say, your friends back in the United States, your colleagues did an amazing job on Hurricane Katrina and Rita. We went from something like zero to 70,000 troops, 20,000 active, and I believe 50,000 Guard and Reserve from all across the country in a relatively short period of days. There were literally dozens of helicopters providing assistance, and the devastation in Mississippi, it just flattened for a good distance in from the coast. And, of course, the devastation in Louisiana was quite different. It was from the flooding of the levees, not the hurricane itself at all, but what took place after that. And the need was great. But while we're on the subject, I should just say one other thing. We think of you all as warriors and war fighters, and that's what you are, and that's why you're here, and God bless you for it. What they did in Katrina and what they did, the United States military in the tsunami in South Asia, and I just came from Pakistan, and what they have done there and are doing there is just amazing. In Pakistan, there were something like 73,000 people killed in the earthquake, over 70,000 wounded, some number of millions of human beings homeless with winter setting in at considerable altitudes. And I'm told that the favorite toy in Pakistan today is a miniature Chinook helicopter. We pulled helicopters from all around the world into Pakistan. They set up promptly, and they began rescuing people and carrying in cargo, and of course most countries don't have heavy lift helicopters, and they were able to put heavy equipment in beyond where the passes and roads were closed off to see that they could work from that end as well as from the lower ends and begin clearing roads and supply people so that the wounded could be taken out, the injured could be taken out, and all kinds of supplies and tents and things. There are cities that don't exist the roofs, when you fly over them, the roofs are just on the ground. The entire foundations are gone, and all you see is a tent city. The entire cities are just nothing but tent cities today. So you folks in the United States military not only do a great job as warfighters, but you've done some amazing things from a humanitarian standpoint as well. So we'll get you that information.
Sir, I'm also concerned about the supply and demand in Gulfport due to the increase in property values while during the time we were here in Iraq. Is there any kind of, how can I put it, are they going to increase our VAH or anything like that?
There is a federal program for everybody. And whether or not there's anything going to take place with respect to people in specific geographic locations that were damaged by the hurricanes, I don't know. But I can certainly find that out as well. It may very well be that everyone will be blanketed in under the federal programs that Congress has passed and is passing. There may not be a need for a specific military-related program. But we'll find that out and see that that's made available to you as well. Where was your home?
Gulfport, Mississippi, sir.
Wow. And was it just wiped out?
Yes, sir. We no longer have property over there. Yeah.
How's your family?
Pretty good, sir. They moved out.
Very good. Thank you. Question? Yes, sir.
Morning, sir. My name is SK2 Lester. I'm attached to NMCB 133 out of Gulfport, Mississippi as well. As you already know, the area was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. And a lot of the families in my unit, they were scattered all over the United States. And they're under safe haven, which is told it will last like 180 days. So that means it would end in like early February. Our unit, it doesn't return until like late April. Can you kind of like provide us with an update on the Safe Haven program as of right now? Will it be extended or not?
You say it was 180 days?
Yes, sir.
This is the broad federal program.
The Safe Haven?
Yes.
Right.
And I've not heard any discussion about whether or not it will be extended, but I know what the government is. This is all outside of the Department of Defense, needless to say. And what they've been doing is working to see that the people who've qualified under the Safe Haven program would be dealt with and taken care of in a variety of different ways prior to the expiration. If they get closer to the expiration, I'm sure they'll address that question. If there still is a universe of people who have not had those problems solved. But that would be something that Congress would address in the new session, probably in January, I would think. How about your house? Did you lose a house, too?
No, sir. My garage collapsed on top of my avalanche. Oh. That's about it.
On top of your what?
On top of my avalanche Chevy truck.
Oh, my goodness. Goodness gracious. Well, that's a shame, but... Thank you, sir. Question, yes?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Secretary. I am Lance Colt McFarland with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force, 2MHG. And my question is a reference to permanent duty stations here in Iraq. As soon as our mission is complete and all troops have retrograded, is there going to be permanent bases out here that Marines will have obligated service to?
That's an interesting question that comes up from time to time, and the answer is we have no idea, but at the moment there are no plans for permanent bases here in this country. The reason I say that is it is a subject that has not even been discussed with the Iraqi government, and we have here a sovereign nation, and up until this most recent election and the process they're now going through to establish their new government, there hasn't been any government to talk to about their interests with respect to bases. So what we've been doing is been working with the first the governing Iraqi Governing Council and then the interim government and the transitional government and passing over responsibility. As you may know, we've, I think, passed over something, transferred responsibility already for something like 17 bases to the Iraqis. But it will be some time, weeks for sure, possibly a couple of months, hopefully not much longer than that, for the Iraqis to decide who their new leadership will be as a result of the elections. The election results have to be certified, and then they have to have some time to decide who would be the senior officials and get approved by the new assembly. And then they have to select ministers, and they have to get themselves in position to begin governing. And at some point thereafter, later this year, one would think that our status with them would be discussed, and to the extent they have an interest in our assisting them for some period over time, then they would raise that with us. If you think of what happened in Afghanistan, you know, we have no desire to have our forces anywhere they're not wanted. Indeed, quite the contrary. We want our forces located in places that are hospitable to them. And we've been adjusting our force posture around the world to achieve that. And it's been a good thing. We're now much better situated for the 21st century with our global force posture adjustments. In Afghanistan, President Karzai held what they call a Loya Jirga, a large meeting, a conference, to talk to the Afghan people about his desire to have the United States and Afghanistan enter into a strategic partnership and agree that we would provide counterterrorism activity in his country and, in addition, some training and equipping of the Afghan military. And a presence for some period, not a big permanent base, to be sure, nothing like we've had in Germany or various in Okinawa or other places, but a forward operating site, a forward location, because for some period of time, he felt, and the Afghan people felt, that they would not have a military capable of serving as an appropriate deterrent in their country. So we've agreed to have a operating site in their country for some period at their request. And I have no idea what will take place with respect to Iraq, but clearly we our goal is to see that there be a single country in Iraq, not broken into pieces, that it be at peace with its neighbors, that it have a constitution as it now does that will protect the Iraqi people from each other and provide the kinds of rights and opportunities for those people. And and we've agreed to help develop their Iraqi security forces so that they can provide for their security, because in the last analysis, the Iraqis have to run Iraq. It's their country. They're going to have a distinctly Iraqi government. They're going to have Iraqi armed forces, and it's their task to govern here. And our task is to help to create an environment where that's a possibility, where they can do that, where they can get from where they were, a vicious repressive regime, that to a country that's at peace in this region and a partner in the global war on terror. How it will evolve, I think, is entirely up to the Iraqi people over time. But I don't envision the United States establishing a lot of the old kind of bases where we were thinking in terms of the tension with the Soviet Union, and as a result had forces in place prepared to defend real estate where they were located. Our forces for the 21st century have to be agile, deployable, and expeditionary, and not defending real estate in place the way we were during the 20th century. So that suggests to me that we're not likely to establish anywhere large bases from a defensive standpoint, but rather operating sites and operating locations and arrangements with other governments that will enable us to use those sites in a way that's effective and of interest from their standpoint, and also effective giving us the kind of mobility and deployability and agility that we're going to need to deal with the kinds of threats and challenges that we see in the 21st century. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Question? Yes, sir.
Mr. Secretary, good morning. My name is First Lieutenant Rob Gebracht with 7th Engineer Support Battalion out of Camp Pendleton. I actually have a statement and a bit of a question, sir. This is my third tour over here. I actually just wanted to say, sir, that I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, I'm a United States Marine. So this is my third tour here. As someone who's had their boots on the deck here two times before, sir, I can actually say I have seen improvements. I have seen changes. One question I have, sir, is how can I and how can my Marines better tell our story to the American people? Because it seems to me that I see news stories occasionally that don't necessarily highlight the fact that my Marines are doing good things every day and really have made an improvement. If I can see it, I wonder why the majority of the American people sometimes can't see the differences that are being made here, sir. And in addition to that, sir, as our mission in Iraq continues for the greater war on terror, where's our next step, sir? Because I won't have the arrogance to speak for the United States Marine Corps, but I know the Marine Corps is ready to execute.
Thank you very much. I guess I don't know the answer to the first part of your question. It is stunning, absolutely stunning, to talk to people here who see progress, who see what's happening, who see that there's clinics are open and schools are open and the stock market's functioning and the currency's been stable and people, there are not masses of displaced people. And the Iraqi people have been successful in moving the political process, meeting every single political benchmark that exists. And yet the focus frequently is on anything but those marks of progress, as you point out. You're here in danger and in conflict, but there's also a test of wills taking place, as I mentioned. And in a very real sense, one of the centers of gravity of this war on terror is back in the United States and particularly in Washington, D.C. And the people we're up against know how to manage the media. They know how to, they have media committees, the terrorists do, and they systematically put out information that they believe will weaken the will of the American people and of Western nations. And it serves their purpose, and they're very good at it. They're very clever. They're very successful. And they lie. And the old saying, I think it was Mark Twain who said that a lie speeds around the earth in seconds, and while truth is still putting its boots on. It takes a long time to prove a negative. So if someone says something that's a lie and it speeds around the world to correct it, you can't prove a negative unless you get on the ground, find out what actually took place, and we have an obligation to tell the truth and to be responsible and to be credible. And so our folks have to go find out precisely what happened. You'll recall the story that was printed about here. It was totally false that a Koran had been flushed down a toilet, and it was printed and it raced around the world, and there were riots in some Muslim countries, and people were killed, and it wasn't true. It never happened. And so we believe in democracy. We believe that the American people, given sufficient information, will find their way to right decisions. And one of the things you can do is what you do. Amazing, if you think about it. For the first time, we're fighting a war in the 21st century where there's email, and there's talk radio, and there's 24-hour news, and there are digital cameras. And you folks are communicating with your families, 160,000 in this country right now, Americans. And every day you're communicating back what you see, what you know, what you think. And it is different than the people back there are seeing with their eyes and ears, hearing in their ears, about what other people's views of what's happening. And they see that difference. And that ripples through our society. And it causes a reduced credibility for information that's put out that's inaccurate over time. But I have a lot of confidence in the American people. They've got a good center of gravity, and what you need to do is what you're doing, and that's to keep telling the truth, keep seeing that the people you know and talk to see the slice that you see of what's taking place, and they're going to be able to take that and synthesize it and internalize it and come to right decisions. It is a test of will, but you know, it's always been a test of will in our country, if you think about it. We were divided during the Revolutionary War with loyalists and revolutionaries. It was a bitter struggle. The Civil War was a bitter struggle with divisions in the country. In World War II, I was alive and watched the vitriolic treatment of President Franklin Roosevelt during that period. And the battle takes place everywhere. And in this modern world we live in, it takes place everywhere all at once. The debate back there is understandable. Wars are never popular. They're never they're ugly things, and they're hard things. And on the other hand, if the people in our country had not persevered in the Revolutionary War, we wouldn't have this country. And if they hadn't persevered in World War I and World War II, we wouldn't have this country. And they persevered notwithstanding all the debate and all the discussion and all the inaccuracies and all the misperceptions. And out of all of that came this solid center of our country. And all I can say is keep sending back emails, keep talking to your friends and families and telling them the truth, and we'll all be fine. What was the second part of your question?
Where to next, sir?
You know, if you think about it, we talk about Iraq, as we should. It's important. We talk about Afghanistan. But what we're in is a global war on terror. There is a struggle in the Muslim religion between a small number of violent extremists who are determined to behead people and kill people and force the world to see things the way they see things, to try to reestablish a caliphate in the world, to overthrow moderate Muslim nations, to attack Western values and Western behavior and Western culture. They're a small minority. The overwhelming numbers of people in that religion are moderate, and they aren't extremists, and they aren't terrorists. But the terrorists understand what the word terror means. The word terror means to terrorize. It isn't to kill. It's to terrorize. It's to affect someone's mind and behavior, to alter their behavior, to make them do what you want them to do. And that strikes at the very heart of what we are as free people. As free people, our very essence is to not be terrorized, to be able to do what we want, go where we wish, say what we wish, live lives that we wish to live. Know we can send our children out to school and they'll come home safely, and to not be frightened and to not alter the way we live. And the terrorists strike at the very heart of that. And so what we're dealing with, what you're dealing with, what our society, in fact, much of the world, the overwhelming majority of the world is dealing with, is a group of people who can take all of the technological advancements that they wouldn't be capable of producing. Free societies produce them. And to use them against us, against our people, against innocent men, women, and children, because they don't discriminate between who they kill. And that is what we're up against. And so you say, what next? And I would say, it is a long war. It is not a short war. It is going to be a struggle that we're going to be engaged in for some time. And it is unconventional. It's irregular. It is not going to be large armies and navies massed against each other as in the last century. It is going to require a new set of skills and talents and a way of thinking. They don't have big bureaucracies that they have to manage. They don't have real estate that they have to defend. They're able to turn inside our circle frequently. They constantly watch what we do and adapt to it and adjust, just as we have to become agile and constantly adapt and adjust to the challenges, the nature of the challenges as they change. So when you say what's next, I think that's what's next, and it's going to be the task of your generation. I wouldn't want to predict for how long, but for a good chunk of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
You're giving me the hook? I'll decide when the last question is. And I'm going to go out on a good one, so let's see how this one is. And then say more people line up, and I'll pick and choose. Yes, sir. Merry
yes,
Christmas
sir.
To you.
Thank you, sir. Staff Sergeant Ray with MHD Motor T. I just had a question about a few select Marines were interested in extending their tours beyond the 365 cap.
But Marines who want to extend their tour in Iraq beyond the period.
Yes, sir. Some were told that that was just out of the question, and that, they said that came from you, sir.
Came from me? I get blamed for more dead burn things that I don't have anything to do with. You can be certain I never said anything like that. I have had, I'm going to guess, three or four meetings with the Commandant of the Marine Corps and the Secretary of the Navy and the Chief Staff of the Army and the Secretary of the Army, trying to figure out why it makes sense for the Navy to have a six-month deployment and 12 months back, the Air Force to work on 3 or 4 or 6 month expeditionary deployments, and the ground forces, in the case of the Army, to have generally 1 year deployments, and the Marines to have 1 year for the higher level headquarters, but 7 months for most of the Marines. And I've listened to their explanations 3 or 4 times, and I still don't understand. And you know, when I listen to something 3 or 4 times and I still don't understand, it makes me wonder if the people explaining it understand. We have, each of the services, of course, manage that themselves. And it never crossed my mind to suggest that people couldn't extend beyond a 7 month period or whatever. And I don't know what the dynamics might be or why somebody might have led you to believe that that's not possible. I suppose unit cohesion is one thing that affects it. But we need people to do what they want to do, because when people are doing what they want to do, they do it well. And if I were you, I'd just keep knocking on the door. Who knows? You might even be able to make it.
Will do, sir.
I like your spirit, though. Good for you. Question? Oh. You folks are going to go along with the general, huh? So that's how this works out here. Well, look it. You are amazing folks, and I am so grateful to you. The holiday season is a period when, of course, you'll be connecting with your families and friends. You'll have a chance to do what we talked about over here and tell them what you think and what you're accomplishing and how you feel about the world and what your hopes and expectations are here. And as long as you keep doing that and you keep telling them the truth and you keep doing the truly spectacular job you're doing, our country is going to be in great shape. So Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah, and God bless you.